Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com. Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. And today with us, we have Matt Nelson. He holds a Bachelor of Education in Physical Education from the University of Regina and is a graduate of Canadian Memorial Chiropractic College. After several years of skepticism, he returned to the Catholic Church in 2010. Matt blogs at reasonablecatholic.com, and his writing has appeared at wordonfire.org and strangenotions.com. He is also a speaker for Face-to-Face Ministries. Matt lives with his wife, Amanda, and their three children in Saskatchewan, Canada. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks for having me on, Pete, and looking forward to talking with you.
Great. Well, so same here. And today we're going to be talking about your book from Catholic Answers, Just Whatever, How to Help the Spiritually Indifferent Find Beliefs That Really Matter. Great book. And in the intro of that book, you talk about religious indifferentism. As a preface to our time together today, can you tell us what exactly that is?
Yeah, you bet. Well, in the book, I use the word indifference and indifferentism together as really the same, meaning the same thing. And the way I describe it is really in two very different ways. I start out with a very general definition of religious indifference. How I define it is the failure to think seriously about religious questions and the failure to give God his due. And so that single definition actually has two components, one intellectual and one practical. But the reality is that in the real world, religious indifference occurs in all sorts of forms and to varying degrees. So I separate the book into three distinct parts. And in each part, I discuss a different kind of religious indifference, which is quite prominent out there today. So those three types of indifference that I discuss is closed indifference, open indifference, and denominational indifference. So it's sort of confusing because I start with a general definition of religious indifference, but really in day-to-day evangelization, we're going to find that indifference occurs in all sorts of different forms and to varying degrees.
Sure. Now, in the book, you give testimony to your own indifferentism and doubts about Catholicism. Can you tell us a bit about that timeline of events and kind of in two parts? First, you were born and raised Catholic. What drew you away?
Right. Well, yeah, I was born into a pretty solid Catholic family. My parents raised me and my four other brothers and sisters in the faith, and like so many other faithful parents out there, they did their best to teach us the faith and to keep us faithful to the church throughout our childhood and teenage years. But when I moved away from home, I moved away about 4 hours to Regina, where I went and pursued a bachelor's degree in education. And while I was there, I was also on a football scholarship. And so most of my community, most of my support system away from home was my football team. And unfortunately, I wasn't surrounded by a whole lot of guys that were really you know, really into a faith of any kind. Religion just wasn't a huge value in that group of guys. And so I think just being immersed in the secular college world and also just having a support system around me who really were religious indifferentists, I think, or at least very private about their religion, slowly just sort of numbed me to that faith that, you know, was stronger when I was younger. And I just sort of drifted slowly away until I found myself skeptical about some of the most core beliefs of Christianity.
And ultimately, what drew you back to the faith?
Well, that could probably be a book in itself, but, you know, there was one specific moment that was really key in me coming back. Despite the fact that there were so many factors at play at different times of my return back to the church, I found myself at 25 years old, preparing to go off to chiropractic college for 4 more years of graduate education. And so during that time, I moved home from Regina to Shaunavon, where I live right now. But I moved in with my parents to stay with them and save some money for a few months before I moved to Toronto, which is a really expensive city to live in. But during that time, you know, a lot of people didn't know that I had drifted so far away from the faith, because now I was pretty good at faking it. If I came home at Easter or Christmas time, I would go to Mass with my family, and it might have looked on the exterior like I was still a devout Catholic. But on the inside, it was a different story. And so people around here, around Shaunavon, where my parents lived, they still thought I was into the faith. And so I was invited to come out to a weekend retreat to help with music ministry for that weekend. And for some still to me unknown reason, I decided that I would actually take part in that. And so I showed up, and my plan was to help out with music ministry. And then I would just kind of sit back in the shadows during all the spiritual stuff, the prayer and the small groups and all that. But by the end of the second day of that retreat, I found myself really moved by the testimonies of the teenagers that were there and the other young adults. And clearly the Holy Spirit was just changing me. And so I decided on that second night that I would go to confession for the first time in a long time and really go and give my first good, honest confession for the first time in my adult life. And so that's what I did. I went to confession that night, and there in the confessional, when I made that confession, it was like a bomb went off, a spiritual bomb inside of me, and something really changed. And that was the beginning of my return to the church.
Excellent. And in the introduction, you have a quote that I think says it all and kind of sets the foundation for the book and our discussion. And that is, quote, "Man is a creature made for both heaven and earth. He no longer knows it. He no longer cares." Now, I want to unpack that a bit. And first of all, let's look at the part, "he no longer knows it." And it seems to me, in this line of work that I do with interviewing authors and working with books, is that part of our problem is a lack of poor catechesis. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think there's lots to say about the state of catechesis in the church. And although I do share some of the pessimism with so many people out there today, I do also see a lot of really positive things happening as well. Because I think we've now known this for a while, that for the sake of the new evangelization, for the sake of taking the gospel out to this increasingly secularized culture, we need to, first of all, come to grips with our faith ourselves and be ready to give a rational account, or at least some kind of a compelling account for what we believe. And so, you know, we've got different ministries, from Catholic Answers to Word on Fire to the Coming Home Network, mm-hmm. To Ascension Press, and so on and so forth, putting out these great programs now to catechize people, not just in their parishes, but in their homes. But that being said, there is so much work still to do. And the unfortunate thing is, as a result of not being well catechized, well taught as Catholics to understand the fundamental beliefs that come with believing what we believe, we lose sight of the most basic questions like, what is a human person? And so when we no longer understand that we've been created and that we've been created with a purpose, we lose sight of the fact that we're not just meant for this life. We're not just some accident that has, you know, kind of just spawned out of natural selection and evolution, but that however we got here, we're here with a purpose and we're destined for something beyond this life. Mm-hmm. So if we're not being catechized and taught properly, those are the sorts of truths about our existence that are going to be easily missed.
And the other part of that is the he no longer cares. People just don't seem to care these days. They have a huge this indifferentism that we've been talking about. And what do you think's led us to that point in crossroads in our society today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are huge questions with so much I could be said about them. But the second question in regards to what we're talking about here is really making me think of Blaise Pascal, the great 17th century Catholic thinker. I mean, this guy was a jack of all trades. He was a world-class scientist. He was a world-class philosopher. He, along with one other man, is known as the father of probability theory. I mean, he was a very smart individual. And he had a profound conversion himself to Jesus Christ and to the Catholic Church during his life. But I don't think anybody in the modern period since the Enlightenment, you know, he was writing in the 17th century, but since then, I don't think anybody has thought as deeply about this question as him. And he says, we fear that religion is true, and we're afraid of what that might mean for our lives and the changes we might have to make. So we keep ourselves diverted. We keep our attention on other things so we don't have to think seriously about the demands of religion. And I think that's at the key of the problem today, is we no longer care because we don't allow ourselves to care. We're too distracted, we're too busy, and we're not sitting back and pondering on life's biggest questions.
Right, and that, in the end, leads us to a problem when it comes to Judgment Day.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. And again, that's the danger of not knowing our godlike dignity and not understanding that we've been created not just for this life, but in fact for another life, for an eternity of happiness. And we're, you know, just so easily distracted with the pursuit of happiness in this life, in things that come to pass, that we lose sight of what's waiting for us on the other side. So yeah, judgment is something that we all are going to have to face eventually. And I'm trying to remember who it was. I think it was Samuel Johnson who said something to the lines of, if you're going to be hanged, it makes your mind increasingly clear, or something like that. Something to the effect of, if we know that our death is right around the corner, it's amazing how serious we start to take questions like, what waits for us on the other side, and will we be judged on how we've behaved in this life?
And we're going to get deeper into this topic when we come back, and we're going to take a quick break right now. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. We'll be right back.
A quick story. I was tucking my young daughter into bed. She was wrapped up like a cocoon in her blanket, as comfortable as could be. I sat on her bed and bent over to bless her with holy water and hug her. I was somehow moved to whisper in her ear, "You're safe. You're safe." She responded with such a peaceful, heavenly look and said, "I am safe with you, Daddy." Isn't this how our Heavenly Father acts towards us? God, your Father, is bent over, embracing you, His beloved child, at this very moment, and longing for you to hear His words for you, as if you are the only person He ever created. He is whispering to you by name, "You're safe." And our response should be, "Yes, Daddy, I'm always safe with you." I'm Jim Littleton, formingfaithfulfamilies.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. With us today, we have Matt Nelson, the author of Just Whatever, How to Help the Spiritually Indifferent Find Beliefs That Really Matter. And we're going to break down your book a bit here, Matt. As you mentioned earlier, it's broken conveniently into three parts, and we have three segments left. So that kind of works out well.
Perfect.
So the first part of the book you have is titled Why Worship God. And within that, you pack a lot. One point being the pointlessness of life without God. So if there's no God, what is the point?
Well, as I say in the book, if there's no God, that means there's no designer, no purpose giver outside of ourselves, which means we give ourselves our own purpose to life. But that's not ultimately what most people are looking for. Most people want to know, not what's my purpose in life, but what's the purpose of life. As the atheist philosopher Thomas Nagel said, we want our lives to matter from the outside. We want someone else out there who has put us into a trajectory towards happiness. And so what I argue in the book is, it's not an original argument to me by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, many philosophers, including atheist philosophers, have admitted that if we're not created for a life after this, then death is ultimately going to be our final destiny. And not only is that a fact pertaining to our individual lives, but the universe as a totality, scientists tell us, is also winding down, as it were, towards its own kind of death, towards what scientists call heat death, where there's no usable energy left in the universe, and it's just kind of like this mist of useless atoms forever and ever. So if there's no life after this, if there's no true redeemer, there's no new heaven or new earth, as it's phrased in the book of Revelation, then ultimately everything, not just us, but everything is destined towards death and nothingness. Mm-hmm. And that's one reason why God matters.
In the book, you bring up a rather interesting topic, and that is, you discuss the book, The Atheist's Guide to Reality, Enjoying Life Without Illusions by Alexander Rosenberg. And as you go down through that list, or the litany of questions, you know, it's a total polar opposite to what the church teaches. And that is, his theory is there a God? No. What is the nature of reality? What physics says it is? What is the purpose of the universe? There is none. What is the meaning of a life? Ditto. Why am I here? Just dumb luck. And it goes on and on and on. And it's a litany of polar opposites of what the church teaches. And to me, that atheist mindset, there's no hope at the end of that list. Can you speak to that a bit, of what you thought when you discovered that?
Yeah, absolutely. Alex Rosenberg is a pretty good philosopher. And one of the reasons why I say that is because he is a materialist, meaning he believes, as many skeptics believe, that all that exists is physical reality. So physical particles and fields of force are essentially it. There's nothing more fundamental than that. So as a materialist, Rosenberg is willing to follow what most people would consider reductio ad absurdum, which is, in other words, something that's so absurd it couldn't be believed. Well, for Rosenberg, he's willing to believe it. He's willing to accept the fact that he is ultimately, just as another atheist has said, a bag of particles or bag of chemicals. And for that reason, he discounts all spiritual reality. So he doesn't believe in the mind, for example. He doesn't believe that we really think about anything. He believes our thoughts are just illusions, and really they just are what they have to be according to what physical laws determine. He doesn't believe in a soul, obviously. He doesn't believe in God or angels or the efficacy of prayer or life after death. And so the reason why I wanted to include these quotations from Alex Rosenberg in the book is because I think that he does a great job of being consistent with what he believes. And I think that for the large majority of people, they're not going to be willing to accept those absurdities. I mean, if his theory is true, that we really have no mind and therefore no thoughts, then we can just refute that by taking a moment and realizing that we're thinking about his comment about there being no thoughts. Therefore, Rosenberg is wrong. It's clear. I mean, let's just say there were thoughts. Then the question for someone like Alex Rosenberg or any other materialist is, what would you want to experience in order to be convinced that thoughts really did exist? And that's kind of something I ride out in that first part of the book, is that basically our fundamental common sense experiences as human beings refute many of the claims made by skeptics today. And so that's really what I was trying to do, is just draw people's attention to the absurdities that arise if we don't accept the reality of God and other spiritual realities.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you state in this section is, no one can be good without God, and that's going to make some non-believers' heads spin. Can you give us some more depth to that statement and what you discovered and meant by that?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously, as a Catholic, I believe that there really is such thing as objective moral truths. or that there are some things that are really right and really wrong and really obligated of us, regardless of our opinions. But what I argue in the book is that if there is no such thing as God, that is, if there is nothing outside of humanity who has the superiority, the competence, the ability to give this moral law that we all feel pressing down upon us, then there's really no good explanation for why any moral law would truly exist. But the paradox is even the most skeptical of people still seem to believe, if not directly in what they will admit, at least in their implicit actions, believe that some things are really right and really wrong. Like, take the most hardened atheist. If somebody broke into their house and broke all their stuff and stole some of their stuff, they would believe and they would act as though something has happened to them that was really and truly unjust and wrong. The claim in the book is not that you need to believe in God in order to be good. I think that there are some atheists out there who are probably more morally sound than many Christians out there. So I do think that you can be a non-believer and still act morally. And that's a biblical fact. We read the first couple chapters of Romans, especially in Romans chapter 2 from St. Paul. He talks about this law that's written on our hearts. So as human beings, we experience the moral law. And the question I ask in the book is, based on this experience of the moral law, can we account for where it comes from anywhere else other than God himself? And I draw out that argument and show that of all the options that people propose of where this moral law comes from, the best explanation for the objective moral law is from God himself.
Mm-hmm. You also point out in this section of the book, the first part, that a Richard Dawkins Foundation article that paints God pretty much as a demanding, narcissistic dictator. Can you tell us a bit about what you found in that article and why that article is inherently wrong?
Mm-hmm. Well, a narcissist has a wrong conception of who they are. They have a sort of exaggerated sense of importance. But for God to desire our worship is precisely in alignment with how great God is. God is infinite goodness. God is infinite goodness, and it's hard to make sense of worshiping anyone except an infinitely good person. So what happens with Richard Dawkins and many other new atheists today, not every atheist, but I'm specifically talking about the new atheists who are sort of new in their emotion, some of the anger behind the things they have to say, and in their tactics, not just to show that God does not exist, but to show that religion and religious people are bad. Those are the sort of qualities of new atheists. And so what they often do is caricature God. They describe God as sort of an anthropomorphized tyrant rather than the God that we truly believe in as Christians. We believe in a God who is infinitely good. Specifically as Catholics, you know, we go with St. Thomas Aquinas, who really is just philosophically building upon how God revealed himself in Exodus chapter 3, verse 14, as I am. St. Thomas Aquinas says that God is the sheer act of to be himself, which means he has all perfections within him, including goodness. What Richard Dawkins does is he positions God as something less than God, something less than a person who would justly deserve worship. And he makes it sound like God shouldn't be making that request on us, when really, if there's anyone in all of reality who can justly and rightly demand worship, it's the perfectly good being of God.
Excellent. We're going to come back in a bit and talk about the other two parts of your book. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. We'll be right back.
We want to help others, especially in places of strife, such as the Holy Land, where Christianity is dwindling by the day. But how to help? Here's an easy way: buying products through the Holy Land gift shop. Every product you purchase at myfranciscan.org/shop helps Christians support their families and stay in the Holy Land. Olive wood, embroidery, spices, and many more authentic products from the Holy Land are available right now at myfranciscan.org/shop. The Holy Land gift shop, bringing the Holy Land home.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, the Catholic book blogger. With us today is Matt Nelson, the author of Just Whatever from Catholic Answers. And Matt, we're going to head into the second part of your book titled Why Worship Jesus. And in an indifferent world, that seems somewhat of a common question. So as an overview for this segment, what's the basis behind your section, Why Worship Jesus?
So just to contrast it with the first section of the book deals with what I call closed indifference. Closed indifference reflects an extreme closed-mindedness towards religion, and it rises out of skeptical attitudes like atheism and deism or the belief in an impersonal God and things like that. Open indifference, which is what I discuss in the second section of the book, is sort of at the other end of the spectrum. Open indifference reflects a radical open-mindedness towards all religions. So a closed indifferentist might be inclined to see Jesus or any other religious person as sort of absurd and living according to illusions. An open indifferentist, on the other hand, would see Jesus as sort of one great teacher, one great prophet among many. So it reduces Jesus to something other than God. And usually these folks will assert something like, well, Christianity is great, but it's no greater than any other religion. There are many paths to God, many religions that will take you to the same God. So take your pick, whichever you like. And there's no one true religion, so do what you want.
Which causes a little bit of chaos and confusion here amongst us. But one thing you point out in this section is the difficulty that is in believing in invisible things. And what can we do to convince those around us to believe that this thing we believe in, that they cannot reach out and touch, is indeed real?
Well, one way we can do this is we can take a bit of a philosophical approach. Now, this book is written for Catholic Answers Press, so obviously it's going to have an apologetic undertone to it, and it's going to provide arguments that we can use. And, right. and offering arguments is really only just a part of effective evangelization. But I think one way that we can start is by showing people that there are other things that they usually without question will accept that are invisible, in fact, that they'll never see. For example, you can ask somebody, well, do you believe that I have a mind? Or do you believe that your spouse thinks about you? They'll never be able to prove those things. They'll never be able to look into somebody else's mind. And yet we walk around all day believing that other minds exist. Now, same thing with moral truths. We can't go out into, you know, India or England or some special place on earth and discover moral truths under a rock. Moral truths are not the sort of things that we can see and detect and do experiments with. They're things that we accept to be real, and yet we can never see them. We can just know them to be true. And a lot of times we can know these sorts of invisible things like moral truths or other minds through philosophical reasoning. And the same goes for God. God has made himself accessible through the natural light of human reason. So what St. Paul says in Romans chapter 1, verse 20, he says, ever since the beginning of creation, God has made his invisible nature known and through the things that he has made. So we can perceive God's existence by looking at what's in front of us and then thinking logically from there. And so that's one way that we can come to discover the existence of invisible things, including God himself, is through reason.
Another thing you included in this part of the book, which I thought was very, very good, is the conspiracy of silence. Can you tell us what that is and why it's wrong?
Yeah, the conspiracy of silence. So we're talking here about why more people didn't write about Jesus. Is that what you're referring to?
Correct. Why people think that in the tomes of history, he may not be recorded as much as some people would like to think he should be.
Right. Okay, I thought this was an interesting thing to bring up from the skeptic's point of view. So you kind of move from this argument of divine hiddenness where it's like, well, if God exists, then where was he? To then us asserting, well, God actually appeared in the flesh 2,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. He gave us exactly what we wanted in Jesus Christ. So then the next objection often will be, well, but if this Jesus really existed, who did all of these amazing things, all of these miracles, and he rose from the dead, well, why didn't more people write about him? It seems like very few people had anything to say about him. But that's not true at all. See, what we need to do if we want to know about Jesus' life is we have to look as a historian of ancient history would look at the writings and the records that we have of ancient Palestine and that Greco-Roman world. One of the reasons, first of all, why more people didn't write about Jesus, you know, because there was like the Jewish philosopher Philo, for example, who was living at the time, like in the first century, could have easily heard about Jesus and written about him, or so it would seem, and yet he never said a word about Jesus. But here's the thing. We can't apply our standards of today to 2,000 years ago. You know, there was no social media. There was no cars, no trucks, no trains, no planes. There was no phones. To take information and have it travel a long distance would have been a lot harder and would have taken a lot more time than it would today, no matter what the event was that was being reported. But on top of that, in the immediate surroundings of Galilee, there was a lot of political and social unrest. And not only that, but in the wider scope of the Roman Empire, there were new religious uprisings and movements going on. And in fact, the things that Jesus was doing and saying would have probably, at least many historians would contend today, would have probably just kind of blended in with the crowd at the time. A lot of times what helped Christianity grow was, yes, the announcement of the good news that Jesus had risen from the dead, but also the supernatural courage that many of the early Christians who were eventually martyred showed. And so it's important to realize that information didn't travel 2,000 years ago in the way it did today. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, though, as the eminent New Testament historian N.T. Wright has said, we have about as much historical proof for Jesus as any other major figure of antiquity. We have not just Christian records of Jesus. We have the four Gospels, all four dated to within the first century. We have the letters of Paul, and we have the early church fathers. But we also have non-Christian records that report about Jesus and mention him. We have Josephus, a first century Jewish historian. We have Tacitus, a Roman historian. Marabar Serapion, a Greek satire writer, that was Lucian of Samosata, who is a Greek satire writer. Marabar Serapion, who is writing a letter to his son from jail, mentions Jesus and the execution of Christ. You know, so there are many records, not just written by Christians, but also non-Christians, who report this Jesus fella, who, I mean, Tacitus and Josephus, both non-Christians, don't just mention the existence of Jesus, they actually mention Jesus' crucifixion or his execution, and Pontius Pilate's connection with it. Mm-hmm. And so those sources are key when identifying not just whether or not Jesus existed, but other important details about Jesus' life, like his crucifixion.
You touched upon this, but there definitely is a record out there that we believe in, and that is the four Gospels, but some will refute those. So how do we mm-hmm. defend the authenticity of the Gospels to those who choose not to believe?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a good starting place is to find out what they would like to see. Like, what would it take for you, if you were a skeptic, I would want to ask you, what would it take for you to believe that the Gospels are really trustworthy? You know, because a lot of times the non-believer wants to set up standards that are not even achievable, you know? Mm-hmm. And so what I try to do in the book is provide arguments for the historical reliability of the Gospels, but I use criteria that just any secular historian would want to use. And so we're not making a special case for the Gospels or for other New Testament writings, but we're just saying, okay, what are the standards that a professional historian who wants to look back into any culture 2,000 years ago, what are the sort of standards that they would want to use? You know, they would want to see early, independent eyewitness testimony. And we have that in at least a couple of the Gospels. You know, John's Gospel and Matthew's Gospel give us strong evidence that they're speaking as, writing as eyewitnesses of the life and ministry of Jesus. Mark and Luke, we have good evidence that they were close associates with people who had seen the risen Jesus. And so there are many reasons to believe that these Gospels were written by early independent writers from the first century who were either directly familiar with Jesus and had actually seen him throughout his life and ministry, or who were very closely associated with those who were directly associated with Jesus. And so I think one of the key discoveries of more recent times is the work done by scholar Richard Burridge, who in the mid-1990s came out with a study which he published in a book called What Are the Gospels? And there he was able to compare the Gospels to other works of ancient historical biography and to show that the Gospels fit into the genre of Greco-Roman biography, and not just biography, but historical biography. And so he was able to change a lot of scholars' minds about the Gospels' historical reliability.
Great stuff. We're going to take one more break, and you'll be right back. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media.
Do you want your family to be safe? Do you want extra special attention given to your prayers by Jesus? Listen, place yourself under the mantle of your mother, the Blessed Virgin Mary. Hold her delicate hand and pray the rosary. When we pray the rosary and let the name Mary tenderly spring from our heart and lips, one can envision with certainty our Lord Jesus, seated at the right hand of our merciful Father, suddenly leaning forward with captivated, special love and attention to our soul, to our needs, all our prayers and all our intentions. For when we love Jesus' mother, Mary, we have instantly become part of his special inner circle upon whom he lavishes extraordinary gifts through his Holy Spirit, Mary's spouse. I'm Jim Littleton, forming faithfulfamilies.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. We've been joined today by Matt Nelson. He's the author of Just Whatever from Catholic Answers. And Matt, we're heading into the final section of your book, and we've been covering these indifferences. We've talked about open and closed. What's the third and final one that you cover in the book?
Yeah, so the third type of indifference that I discuss in the book is called denominational indifference. So we would be wrong to assume that spiritual indifference exists only outside of Christianity. I mean, the unfortunate fact is that we find indifference, at least a form of indifference, within Christianity itself. So it doesn't take a genius to know that there's many denominations of Christianity in existence today. Mm-hmm. So many different churches and confessions. And when we get down to the doctrines that are asserted by these different churches and confessions or denominations, we find contradictions. You know, we find direct and irreconcilable disagreements about what Jesus taught and what he passed on to the apostles and what they passed on to the church. Now, fine, that's just, you know, you take into account the inevitabilities of sin and enough time, and you're likely going to find that there's going to be some fractures in church history as we go along. But what's important is that for those of us that claim that we believe biblical Christianity, it's essential that together we go to the scriptures in a spirit of Christian unity, and that we seek the truth together, because it should be a first priority as part of having the most complete relationship we can with Jesus Christ to know what it is that he taught us about himself and about his church. And so denominational indifference is the failure to take seriously the doctrinal differences that exist among denominations. And I unfortunately think that this is quite a big issue today, and it's something that we need to try to change.
Right. I mean, and essentially everything's become so splintered. anyone that feels like starting a church can start one at the drop of a hat, as long as they have the money to support it and get things off the ground and buy a building, which really confuses the masses, I think. Masses as in people, not the service.
Yes, right. Yeah.
So you talk about this in this section as well, and I want to touch upon it here. What is it that Protestantism cannot offer that Catholicism does?
Mm-hmm. Well, I propose in that third section three things which the Catholic Church can offer that no other church on earth can offer, as in like no other Catholic Church can offer, because as we know, within the universal Catholic Church, there's different rites. But I would say, like, including the Eastern Orthodox, there's no other church on earth that can offer these three things. First is unity in truth, or unity in doctrine. All right, and I mean like complete unity, where what is taught is infallibly taught. Only the Catholic Church can offer that plus the next two types of unity. The second type of unity is unity in Jesus Christ through the Eucharist and the sacraments. And the third type of unity that the Catholic Church offers is unity as church. So unity, not just among the members of the body of Christ here on earth, but complete unity, not just between us here, but those in heaven and in purgatory. Mm-hmm. So I'm not claiming that there are, you know, in the Eastern Orthodox Church, for example, they have vowed sacraments, which means that they do partake in that complete communion that occurs when you receive the Eucharist. But because they reject some important doctrines, not very many, but they reject, for example, the infallibility of the Pope or the Roman bishop. And for that reason, they're not in full participation in the doctrines that were passed on by the apostles. So my claim is there are these three types of complete unity, which can only be found in the Catholic Church. And then I try to defend those three unities and that big contention.
Mm-hmm. One of the big ones there you mentioned is, I think, the overall family of the church, and that is the saints. And what role do the saints have in your own return to the church, and how can they help those who have left?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, the saints, especially Mary, has had such a huge impact on my life. And this is an interesting thing. And again, like when you read the book, you get probably a better sense of it than you'll get through listening to this podcast or any mm-hmm. other shorter interview. But, you know, I was always wavering. You know, one day I'd have nothing good to say about Catholicism, and the next day I'd be defending something that I heard somebody misrepresent about the church. When things got really bad for me, even during my most skeptical, difficult, dark times away from the church in my early 20s, I can remember pulling out my rosary and not even being 100% sure how to pray a complete rosary, but just praying it to the best I could, because it gave me peace, you know, turning to Mary. And it's like in that moment, I was able to get past my skepticisms and pray, maybe just with the hope that Mary really was there to take my petitions on my behalf to God. And so the saints have always kind of, and like as a kid, you know, being raised in a Catholic family, I mean, my parents often used the saints to try to inspire us to live a holy life. But, you know, especially now coming back to the church and rediscovering saints I didn't know about earlier, holy men and women like Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati, who was a young man, I think he died when he was 24 years old, but he was a mountain climber and a really good skier, and he smoked a pipe, and you know, he was the sort of guy that a lot of us young guys could relate to, and, mm-hmm. and yet he was a very holy man. The saints have always been a big key to me walking the right path, but you know, especially now, there's just so many inspirational people out there who aren't just inspirations, but are actually people active in our lives now, praying for us here and now, who, if we persevere to the end, will one day be with us in eternity.
So the postscript of your book is very good. And I have to ask, as we wind down our interview here today and our time together, mm-hmm. how do we go about evangelizing the indifferent? We've talked about the reasoning for their indifference and their justifications, but how do we go about doing the evangelization we need to do to bring them back.
Well, I think the first key is ask good questions. All right. People like to talk about themselves. Like, let's not kid ourselves. We all like to talk about ourselves. We like to talk about what we're interested in. We like to talk about our story. And I think that that's a really good starting point, is like, ask people, why do you believe what you believe? You know, how did you get there? Because didn't you grow up in a Catholic family, but you don't believe it now? I'm just interested to know why, what happened. You know, give people the front seat, give them a chance to talk about where they're at, and then listen. Oh man, we gotta be heroic in how we just listen, and that we don't just jump in ready with every argument or objection to what they've got to say. I mean, we need to listen and earn the right to then have a more intense, rational discussion. So ask good questions, be prepared to listen and listen and listen. And then from there, we can follow Blaise Pascal's program for evangelizing the indifferent, which I kind of break down in the book. You know, first of all, we want to show that faith and reason can go together, that they're complementary and that they're not opposed to one another. And that includes science. We want to show in this increasingly technological age that you can be scientific, you can have a great reverence for science, and still be a man or woman of faith. The second, so that's step one from Pascal, is show that faith and reason are compatible. Number two is make the person you're speaking with wish that Catholicism was true. Make them wish it was true. And, you know, there's so much that could be said here. Maybe you want to evangelize through the beautiful, right? Maybe you want to introduce to them or read with them the Lord of the Rings, and then show how Tolkien had this strong Catholic spirit from which he was writing from. And, you know, if you desire a king like Aragorn in real life, did you know there is a king even greater than Aragorn in reality? He's your king and you don't even know it. You know, so there's different ways we can approach that. Tell the story of the gospel, and that's worked for every generation as far as attracting people to the truth. And then step three is just show them that it's true. So you show faith and reason go together. You make them wish that Catholicism was true. And then finally, you use your arguments, use reason, and you show them that it's true. And then you leave it up to God, because God's the, at the end of the day, God's the one that's going to bring about that conversion. So you take it to prayer after that, and you wait for good things to happen.
Right on. Matt, great book. I encourage everyone listening to go get a copy and check it out. Do you have any other projects on the horizon?
You know, not book-wise right now. I'm kind of riding this one out. This is my first book, so we'll see how things go. But I do contribute regularly to the Catholic Answers online magazine, as well as the Word on Fire blog. And I'm working full-time as a consultant right now with Word on Fire and with Bishop Barron for their upcoming Word on Fire Institute, which will be coming out later this year. So stay tuned for that. But no writing projects on the go right now as far as major projects go.
Gotcha. And where can people find this book?
Well, I would encourage you to go to Catholic.com and go to their online store, where you'll find this book, Just Whatever, but you'll find a lot of other great books written in the same apologetic spirit there. And I would imagine you could probably find Just Whatever probably anywhere else where books are sold. So.
Excellent. And that's all we have time for today. Matt, I want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule. Any closing thoughts?
Yeah, I would just encourage people to be fearless out there and just, you know, be in this time when it seems like our faith seems to so many people to be irrelevant. Just, you know, to steal the words of the great St. John Paul II, be not afraid, and preach the gospel with excitement, joy, and boldness.
And with that, you've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. And until next time, God bless.